diversity, and especially women in the room, shift the conversation from battle of personalities to battle of ideas. If it's the same, your people around the table, usually the executive team, look the same, it becomes hierarchical. Who has stronger personality? If you have women and that diversity at the table, suddenly that energy dissipates and it comes back at what is the best idea on the table.
Welcome to the X Factor, where we visit with proven private equity-backed leaders to unpack a compelling area of value creation to help our listeners gain an edge. X Factor is presented by Private Equity CXO, the world's largest digital community of PE-backed executives. You can find a link to PECXO in the description to start your free membership and unlock exclusive content. I'm your host, Rob Huxtable, partner at Falcon, a retained executive search firm exclusively recruiting C-level leaders for private equity-owned portfolio companies.
We have a unique episode for you today. My name is Lindsay Gazowski, partner at Falcon and CEO of The Crucible, and I am guest hosting X Factor this week. We're excited to get into today's topic on defining a path forward for executive women in private equity. I'm joined by two PE-backed CFOs, Lynn Berriman, CFO at True Blue Car Wash, and Anna Onan, CFO at Baker Hill Solutions. Welcome, panelists. Thank you, X Factor, for having us on today's show, and let's get into it.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So let's start here just by talking a little bit about your personal journeys in breaking into private equity. So Lynn, maybe I can kick it to you to start and share how you got into PE and where it's brought you to today.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I've been a CFO for about 14 years, and that tenure has been mainly in private equity held companies and all really small to medium sized high growth, which is very typical in the PE space. And prior to that, my journey was really with small, medium sized companies. Outside of my first entry out of college, which was a bigger company, my experience set has always been in that play space. And so when I went to my first gig with private equity and I was recruited out of an existing CFO position, what I heard and what I liked about the endeavor was everybody is aligned. You know what you're working towards. Everybody's goal is the same, fast-paced, driven, all those things that were kind of inherent in my work ethic, and also what I thought would lead to the most amount of success. And so when I entered into my first PE experience, all those things existed like times 10. You know, it was very fast-paced. It was very demanding. There was a lot of learning on the job, not so much with the skill set that I had, but just the environment and the players that you dealt with on a day-to-day basis, including the PE firm, lenders, CEOs, board of directors, et cetera. And I would say that just figuring out how to balance the time that was required of me and how you build the team out so that you're successful were one of the two most important takeaways that I had early on. And since then, which I'm now, I guess, in my fourth or fifth gig, that it just becomes all the more important that you set yourself up for success from the beginning. And that really starts with being transparent and communicating with the right people.
My path was more meandering, because you can probably hear from my accent, I'm a first generation immigrant that came to the United States by myself. So it was finding a path. For one thing, it was first finding a job, period. That was fabulous. But I went from large enterprises, Ford and Hertz, to jump to public accounting, you know, and top five, big five at that time, lived through the collapse of Arthur Andersen, went into consulting and CFO outsourced services, where you are close to private equity, but not quite, because there you may battle some of the personality quirks of owners, then went into venture capital, then back into large publicly held enterprise, and finally to private equity. And what I learned on that not very straightforward journey is that private equity does combine the speed of decisions, very fast pace. I think you'll hear this word over and over today. It's fast pace. If you cannot live with fast pace, this is probably not the environment where you can succeed. But it is, you're close to decision making, everybody is aligned, and you have both owners who are sophisticated and typically very sophisticated teams as well. And you can benefit from the networks of your private equity owners, but still combined with a nimble approach and decision-making of a smaller enterprise. So that's what I found the magic combination for me in private equity.
Both of you talked a little bit about developing relationships and using those relationships to increase that transparency, increase that ability to be on the same page as the various stakeholders. Do you see any gender-based advantages to how you approach situations that led to those successes? Or are these more generally just a piece of advice for anyone in private equity that you both happen to be able to take advantage of? Lynn, I'll kick it to you first.
Sure. I mean, certainly when I think back about my responsibilities in my work life and my personal life, things like organization, task management, thoroughness, all those things are inherent for success in both spaces. Also, it's good to have a balanced leadership team. I think all but one of my CFO roles, I've reported to a male CEO. There's a great balance because there just is inherently some personality differences. I believe I bring to the table the ability to be the go-between between parties. I think that's a role that women take on a lot, whether it's their kids or their spouse or what have you. And a lot of times I would play that kind of in-between role with the PE firm and with the CEO. And more often than not, that's, I think, the model, because PE people are financial people. So they're going to somewhat, you know, rely on the CFO for a lot more than I think people know and expect.
You know, research has shown that firms with more women in senior positions tend to be more profitable, more socially responsible, and provide safer, higher quality customer experiences. Given that, clearly, the mentoring of women into these senior leadership positions is absolutely critical. Anna, you're on the board of a national women's mentoring organization. Do you want to speak a little bit about steps you're taking to mentor people, women specifically, as they move up through your organization and how that is being conducted writ large across the country?
Absolutely. Mentoring has been my passion. And as we speak about equal opportunity and advancing female talent, I learned that it's really one person at a time. And that's what I have been doing for the past 7 years. Mentoring, I haven't missed a single mentoring cycle in those 7 years. And I'm on the board of Pass the Torch for Women, an organization that focuses exactly on that. We have kind of four tiers. I'm the legacy leader, so senior professional, but then we have developing leaders, those who are, you know, breaking into more VP director, on the path to C-level, developing professionals out of college, probably the first 10, 15 years out of college, and then students, primarily students from challenging backgrounds. I find that one, it's very important to find mentors. Of course, it's very important to have them in your organization, but I appreciate these opportunities within Pass the Torch. It is because we mentor and network with professionals who are in much broader and different industries. So it's best practices, and you just have more freedom of talking about my current mentees' aspirations that may be outside of their company and maybe outside of the industry they're in. So they have the freedom and the mentor to look 20 years into their future. But I do believe in kind of making that bigger goal of, you know, just growing the next generation of leaders into a more manageable scale. I would say I've been mentoring unofficially both of my direct reports and telling them what would it be like to be a CFO for private equity. They're already living kind of a portion of, you know, they see my position, they see how private equity works. So we have very candid discussions, the good, the bad, the ugly, and the wonderful. And I think that is exactly how we can grow the population and bring more talent, women, and other layers of diversity into private equity. Because ultimately, I believe private equity is a very good place for diversity because it's very meritocratic. If you can deliver, you will be accepted and you will be successful in private equity. If you can deliver results fast, you should consider private equity. But it helps to have a mentor and establish relationships.
And what are some other practical steps that either of you are doing in order to bring more women into private equity-backed executive roles, or that you'd like to see sponsors doing to bring more women into these roles?
That's really interesting because you have to go out and recruit and mentor on purpose, as opposed to, I think what a lot of firms do is they sit back and say, we'll hire anybody. We'll hire a diverse set of people. And I'll revert back to just a little story when I was at PCA Skin and we got bought by Colgate-Palmolive. I would say, have the most diverse workforce I've ever seen. Now they're global, so that's easier to do in some respects. But the CEO said to me and the current CEO of PCA Skin, I know that you're recruiting with the intent on bringing in a wide variety of people, including women, but are you purposely going out and finding those? Are you developing a strategy to go out and specifically find the people that will create a diverse set of a leadership team or what have you? And that really resonated with me because I don't think most firms take that next step because it's harder. That's harder to do. But I think if you really want to get to that point, you have to set kind of a mission to go out and do it on purpose with trying to retain a very balanced and well-qualified employee set.
Lynn, let me ask you, how did you purposefully go and find diverse candidates?
Colgate-Palmolive had a certain set of initiatives where if a position came open, they would actually pull from their global network and they would construct, we want to see 2 women, you know, we want to see 3 minorities, we want to see X. And instead of the managers going and saying, here's my favorite or here's who I want to see promoted, they actually had to think out of the box about, okay, of all the employees we have, who fits in that diverse background? Do they have the skill set? And if they have 90% of the skill set, how do we get them to 100? Because you don't have to always solve for 100% when trying to create the skill set and the makeup of a team that you want. Sometimes it's okay to get 85% as long as you have a path to get to 100.
Well, that's actually an interesting point because there were a number of studies done, and granted they're like 15 years old at this point, but that men will apply to a job when they hit roughly 60% of the qualifications, but women need to be more than 90% before they'll apply to a job. And this is a quick plug for Falcon here, but we are very intentional about going out and saying, what are the skill sets we need to find? Not necessarily who fits all of the initial intangible criteria that's set forward or who looks like other people that are already in our clients' funds. It's more about how can we find someone who has all the skill sets we need and try to bring a diverse group of people to the table by gender, by race, by background, by any number of things that increases the likelihood that new ideas are brought to the table. So that intentionality, I think, is really important.
I just finished The Better Allies by Karen Catlin. We discussed it in our Baker Hill Diversity Book Club. And that's what the author mentioned there, that men feel comfortable applying it about meeting 60% of qualifications. And the stats for women were even higher, over 100%. So if it's 5 years of experience, a woman would feel more comfortable if she has 7 years of experience. Oh. Or applying for a position. And one of the tactics to counter that they recommend is maybe including in the job posting those who do not meet 100% of qualifications, we would still love to hear from you. So it opens the door for diverse candidates, not just women. But I would say, kind of to springboard from Lynn was describing, going and pulling these candidates forward. And that's why I asked the follow-up question, where did you find them? I thought that it was very good, and it was a very robust interview process when I went through the interview, when Lindsay was my recruiter. But it only improved since then by the private equity. And I find that case studies are very useful. So when you bring a candidate, especially at the C-level, and spend an hour and a half for them presenting the company, presenting the industry, it really fleshes out how quickly people can learn about your company, how well they are familiar with the industry, how much they invested in interviewing for this position. And actually, as a female candidate with an accent, I found that robust process very useful, because at the end of the day, we would like to be at the table. We would like to be hired as quality candidate, not a diversity candidate for the sake of diversity, right? We just want the top opportunity. So I would say private equity did impress me with how robust the process was, fleshing out the skill on many levels, both soft and hard skills, including taking a time test on Excel, so understanding the value proposition and kind of building the value of a company for the exit. So I would say I would recommend for any private equity of any size to make sure that they have their robust interview process that includes case studies.
Fabulous. Well, let's talk a little bit about changing gears here, about differential expectations you faced around managing family and work, or creating that sense of responsibility to both home and work lives. Women tend to take on, even when they're the breadwinners in the family, a larger share of at-home responsibilities for a variety of reasons. Talk to me a little bit about what kinds of different expectations you've seen from your sponsors, and also how you've seen that balance playing out across your experiences in PE.
Sure. Well, as Anna pointed out, I think expectations are always high. And expectations are high for myself. That didn't change when I entered PE. It just more was validated. And it's very results driven. So there's not as much sensitivity or awareness of how you get to the result as what the result is. That's very clear. I think it was always clear from the beginning. So when I initially entered PE, I worked a lot, like a lot, because I think I took on all the responsibilities at work, and I was taking on a lot of the responsibilities at home. It was kind of an exercise in deciding where you're going to spend your time. You can't do 8 things with a high level of excellence. You could do 3 things or maybe 4 things, but I think I had to adjust my expectations across the board to understand that I couldn't do 8 things with excellence. It's just not enough hours in the day. I figured out that I was kind of self-inflicting that pain a little bit, and that I wasn't at times asking and telling people what I needed. So that was a takeaway. Like, you can't expect people to support you and to give you what you need unless you're clear about what that is. And mm-hmm. You don't need to be a martyr. And women tend to be martyrs. You know, they want to take on the world and they want to do everything themselves, based on my experience. So it was key for me to go and just logically say, here's what I need, whether it's flexibility, whether it's resources, whether it's the team that sits underneath you. And fast forward to today, there's a much better balance. I have a great team. I have enough resources. I have a CEO and board that I can articulate that to, that's responsive. The balance is much better. I think you can get a little off track because the demand is limitless, right? so you have to put boundaries on it and figure out through your relationship how that's going to work going forward, so that in 3 years you're still at a highly functioning level and you're not, you know, completely burnt out.
I would echo what Lynn is saying. I took the position with private equity when my kids were both very active teenagers, and my daughter was playing, you know, soccer at a level where we were at a different tournament pretty much somewhere across the country year round. And one of the considerations was, will I miss her game? Will I miss this part of our lives? And the truth is, I would say for those women who are considering it and maybe self-selecting out, don't. Because if you're interviewing for a VP or C-level position, the pressure will be there, but you will have the flexibility. Hey, we got to C-level, right? We can dictate where we're doing the work and when the meetings are. So back to that same anecdote, I probably missed 3 or 4 games out of 6 years of very intense soccer career. I made all of the rest of them. And another consideration, for example, was spring breaks. Quarter close, 100% falls on the spring break. So what do we do? We always go on spring break. I get up at 6 before anybody else is up. Review what's coming down the pipeline before 9, gone with life. I would say, again, private equity requires results, but where and how you deliver is very much in the hands of a CFO and of any CXO stepping into the position. I think the pressure is going to come, but you can push back a little bit, and as long as you're delivering, you know, your owners and investors, they're doing it themselves. At the end of the day, they're very understanding.
Have you guys seen more flexibility over the last couple of years with more of the work from home flexibility that COVID necessitated?
Definitely. Absolutely. It also depends upon kind of the makeup. Honestly, it depends on the PE firm you're working for. It depends on what kind of CEO you're working for. I think there's quite a few dynamics in play, but definitely the last couple of years have facilitated a much more flexible environment.
Let's say this is one silver lining of COVID. It taught everybody, you had no choice but to learn what can and cannot be done from home. So that is definitely the advantage. And I think we're on the flip side of that is after you go for a year and a half remote work, when do you come back to the office? Our company now is in the work first mode, which means if you can to be at work, be in the office, in the physical office. But it also allows flexibility, you know, between the supervisor and the employee. And I think it brought another element that it's almost so obvious you miss it, but it's very important. It's time of the day. So we encourage employees, and I try myself, to be there in person for key meetings when you need to look the person in the eye, or you need the wraparound whiteboard because you're brainstorming and you will fill that whiteboard. But then if I need to drive my daughter to another practice, you know, I can duck out at 3 and then get back online. I'll be either in the parking lot or at home continuing to do what I need to do. So that flexibility, I would say COVID did teach everybody, every manager, every leader, every investor, a lot of things can be done remotely. And that should help our female and diverse candidates. It has already opened mental doors. Now it just needs to open physical doors into leadership.
And are either of your firms doing anything as a sort of an explicit program or a less well-defined soft skill concept to help primary caregivers who may have had to take a break to not be in the workforce come back in and continue to advance their careers, sort of the off-ramping and then on-ramping that happened a lot over the last couple of years, but has been sort of a feature of many women's career histories for generations.
Well, I would give credit to Baker Hill, my current company. Even when I started, you know, we already had, and since then hired women who took, you know, more than 10 years to be primary caregivers, and we structured the day so they could go and meet the kids off the bus, whatever the requirements. I think the importance of everybody caring, the burden of home life and home responsibilities, it's actually allowing more men to step in as well. So we're encouraging men to take as much flexibility and go help their families as we do women. I would say it's not a formal program, but Baker Hill has been fairly flexible even before I joined the company. And it helps. It helps attract talent and still see fairly low attrition even now.
Just a quick follow-up on something there. You mentioned encouraging men to take advantage of the same flexibility. Do you see that that's a more common phenomenon these days, that men are taking advantage of that flexibility? Or is that something that a continued encouragement may level some playing fields?
Yes, I would say that's an effect of millennial generation. I definitely see my kids on kind of on the very tail end of millennials. But yes, it's almost an expectation at this point, and that's very encouraging.
It definitely, with a certain set of employees, that's absolutely true.
It's interesting because one of the historical statistics is that women enter finance at the same rates as men coming out of college, but they drop out of it by the time they hit 30 at significantly higher rates. Both genders have an abandonment of finance at rates that are higher than other career paths, but women tend to leave significantly more often. And a lot of that has to do with choices made around starting families and caring for families. So if in theory, there's more flexibility being adopted by both genders, we'll see less of that going forward. But any commentary on how we can keep women in finance, given that you're both CFOs, to get them to that C level?
Yeah, so I have one child, and when he was younger, I had to be pretty thoughtful about the moves I was going to make from a career perspective. Like, that was the overriding consideration, because I could only take on so much. I actually made conscious decisions along the way because of the fact that I had a younger child. And probably today, those considerations wouldn't be as prevalent. But certainly 15 years ago, I had to really, really think hard about my next move, because I didn't want to end up in a situation where I couldn't perform, but I wanted to advance my career. And the one thing that it did do, though, is it really made me stick things out, even in times of kind of uncertainty or chaos. Like today, I think people jump ship really easy. You know, they go from their tenure is lower. They go from this role to this because they're unhappy. But what I learned by having to be very careful is I learned how to stick it out. Not everything is going to be great, but you learn how to get through tougher times. And today, I think it's a little easier to go from this job to this job and this job. You lose something in that process because you're not learning to get through the bad things. You're only learning to appreciate the good things.
To help develop a richer skill set, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yes.
I think it's good to have breadth of experience, and that's fine. But I agree with you, Lynn. It's very important to get past those 3 to 5 years. And I would give advice to those who are still maybe 10 years or less out of college. It is the time when you just change positions and jobs more frequently. But there is a magic that only comes after 3 to 5 years, the degree of understanding of industry, company, relationships, and skill. That if you don't get there, you will not understand what it brings to the table, both your own comfort and your value to the company.
Earlier in this conversation, we were talking a little bit about the fact that PE is really actually a great place for people who can deliver and can perform regardless of race, gender, creed, et cetera, because of the meritocracy. Interestingly, so Falcon did a study on compensation, and we saw that women don't do a worse job of negotiating their comp, meaning they're basically getting paid exactly what men are for various levels of experience and sizes of companies, despite the fact that that's not true at executive levels elsewhere in American business. So talk to me a little bit about why you guys think that's the case in private equity, and also other benefits of private equity for women in particular.
I've never felt like I was getting like something less. Maybe I felt like I should be paid as much as the CEO, but I never thought that I was being paid less than my peers. The PE firms approached it as, here's the leadership team we're trying to build out. Here's the economics of that team. Not so much you and this person and this person, from base to incentive comp, all those things. I always felt like I was on par. PE pays more, I would say. I don't necessarily have a lot of data to say that just because I've been in it for a while, but I get calls and I would say it's lucrative and you're compensated for the hard work that you do. And not only that, but you have a opportunity to have a stake in the company. So you have an opportunity to have equity and you can drive the results that equates to value at the end. And really, that's amazing. If I would have looked at that when I graduated college and said, this is the situation I'm going to be, I would have said, no, there's no way. But that's the economics of the deal. And I think the reward for the work is equitable.
How many industries? I would say this was personally my first place that was in PE where I felt, out of all of my 20 years that preceded PE, where I felt that I was equally compensated. And I've done my research and I felt pretty good about that understanding. And equity, it is present both in venture capital and private equity. In venture capital, it's a little less certain. It's a different stage of the company life cycle. But yes, the equitable pay for your effort plus equity. I'm not aware of any other place to get this, except for maybe, with some of the publicly traded companies, but not all of them.
And internally at your companies, are there any initiatives around pay equity, or is it just simply not an issue?
Yeah, that's always a topic, but I think it trickles down. I'm pretty confident, if I think about it, that trickles down and we're being thoughtful about making sure that we're paying everybody appropriately and that compensation. Like we just gave equity to the next level down in our organization. So we're fighting the fight to get people to take on the ownership of the company that I feel and that the CEO feels. And that makes a better output. I think it's happening and there's a good result out there.
I made the comment that pay equity is always an issue. I would say it's not an issue of gender imbalance or diversity imbalance. It's really keeping up with the market now and the battle for EBITDA, just being very deliberate and looking what moves the market in certain positions have made over the past year. We do it at least annually and seeing what we can do with always constrained resources.
Well, we can have you guys back on to discuss inflation in 3 or 4 months. Yeah. Be a big topic then. I'd love to hear from you guys what you think the greatest strengths that women bring to the table in a private equity-backed environment are.
Sure. I actually spent quite a lot of time thinking about the value of women and the value of diversity, really answering this question for myself, not just the politically correct answer, but really knowing it in my heart. And what I arrived at diversity, and especially women in the room, shift the conversation from battle of personalities to battle of ideas. If it's the same, you know, people around the table, usually the executive team, look the same, it becomes hierarchical, who has stronger personality. But if you have women and other diversity at the table, suddenly that energy dissipates and it comes back at what is the best idea on the table. So it changes decision-making and it makes the company stronger. I truly believe that. And the other strengths, if you do not have a woman at the table making decision of how your company is going to function, you're mm-hmm. going to miss very important considerations and topics. You need to have variety of representation to make sure that your company considers all those new topics that we're learning in real time. There aren't enough articles to read on that. You have to live the reality of it to really be able to make decisions. And I would say also to give a stat contribution to the bottom line, we just ran analysis, the cost of regrettable attrition. For a company that is very good with using internal referrals, promoting from within, but it is a very technical environment, so ramp up is fairly long and very technical industry. The cost is about 44% of the base of the employee who is leaving. So say you have a $100,000 employee who left the company, it will cost us $44,000 to get somebody else in, get them onboarded, and that includes recruiting costs or internal referral costs. And I would say that's what women bring to the bottom line as one of the lowest hanging fruit. If you do not have attrition, that's critical for private equity. You already have the talent, high-performing talent who can survive and deliver in private equity environment. 44,000 at a time, every person who hasn't left. It's very simple math.
I agree with everything Anna said. And, you know, just to add to that, I think there's care, understanding, multitasking, organization. Not to say that not everybody has those skills, but I think there's some real practical skills that having women as part of the team bring to the table that's truly important and really adds value.
Any additional comments that you guys would like to make to close this out?
Question for you. I think with your advice, because you have been in this industry for a number of years, right? Trying to recruit diverse talent. What recommendation would you give to potential candidates?
Some of the things you guys discussed earlier about emphasizing the skills, emphasizing the results, emphasizing things that are the tangible pieces of what you've done and why you've done them, and making sure that that any personality issues are overcome by the fact that you just demonstrate success. And it's not necessarily success because you've been in a private equity-backed environment before or because you've been in that specific industry, but a track record of success and the idea that you're willing to stick to it through difficult times, and the idea that you can be creative and thoughtful and truly be a driver of that success, I think is really important, and important for women in particular, because they may not get the benefit of the doubt in all processes. It's also putting yourself out there. And I think that's a piece of it that not enough underrepresented executives do, is to say, yeah, look at me, I'm worthy of this role. And it's something I think we're all coached against at various points of our careers. To say that you're the one who deserves something may not feel comfortable, may not feel like it's the right place to be, but it's the only way to be noticed in a competitive landscape. Right now, it's kind of nice because it is a job seekers market mm-hmm. where there are probably more jobs out there at this level than there are people that are truly qualified to fill them. And so it's a question of finding the right fit. And I think that's the other piece of it that I would recommend, that as people go through these processes, they find the places that are the best fit for themselves. And that as executive women in these organizations, we help to share what someone's actually getting into and help them through that onboarding with transparency, with setting up the lay of the land in order to help them succeed, as opposed to throwing everyone to the wolves and hoping people come back. Apologies to the commenter if this was supposed to be paraphrased before shared, but your panel has been very helpful. I am 9 months into a CFO role and working way too many, more than 80 hours a week. Your comments about relying on others on my team and setting clear expectations was very helpful. Any suggestions in recruiting finance talent in this extremely competitive market?
I mean, that's tough. There is a shortage. There's a shortage of really good, talented accountants / finance people. I would say at the entry to mid-level, like even the controller level, translating that to a good team when there's a shortage of people is hard. I have found myself making sure that when I'm interviewing people, I'm selling them, like I am showing them the path, because I hear so many people that interview, it's all about, is this candidate good for us? But not the other way around. Right. And you're way more successful if you can get that person in the door and demonstrate a connection and a path, describe the environment, like we're asking, give somebody maybe more of a chance than maybe what they're indicating on paper. I think maybe you, just like we're asking for someone, take a little bit of the leap at times, we should do that on the other side too, take the responsibility for the mentoring and the training and all those things that are needed for that person to be successful.
Absolutely along the same lines. I had good success hiring with a little bit less experience for those challenging roles. The person really flourished and overperformed. So I would say trying to overcome the ageist bias on both sides, because we had good success hiring maybe those who are at the end of the career and want to step back a little bit. So I would say expand your candidate pool where you're looking a little bit wider, both the age and maybe into different categories, also successful in bridging between accounting and finance, fairly cross-pollinating markets at, I would say, direct MVP levels, because at that point, that talent has a good grasp of either one, can do either accounting, complex accounting, or complex finance.
And I'll echo what both of you said and just reiterate that in hiring for skills and aptitude are more important than hiring for someone who's done your specific thing in the past. So maybe you're in a services business, but there's a truly phenomenal accountant who spent their entire career in manufacturing. Okay. If they can do the job at hand, a lot of things in finance are more fungible than I think we historically have given ourselves credit for. A follow-up question, what are the top qualities you look for in a controller?
Skill, of course, but ability to lead teams, because controller in our company leads the largest team reporting to that position. So I made a mistake of chasing the skill a little bit harder than leadership and had to make a correction on that. Right now, I would say both the skill that can be verified really through references at this point, but looking for leadership qualities as well.
Completely agree. I mean, skill is a given, right? They have to be a solid accountant to be a controller. But the leadership, like my controller has more people reporting to him than I have. And there are a wider variety of skill sets, supervision skills and leadership skills and communication and relationship skills are just almost equally important as the technical skills.
What's interesting, there's a study on what actually makes great executives and great leaders. And the only thing that usually comes back as statistically significant in those studies is intellect. So all else equal, hire the smarter person as long as they have the communication and leadership skills to work with others.
Interesting. Lindsay, do you have all those studies on Falcon CXO? Because you keep
a lot of them are on Falcon CXO. We can put together sort of a link roundup after this as well and post it as a comment back to this event.
That sounds great. And you were mentioning kind of parting what to leave our participants with. I would say check out Falcon CXO, because I think you're trying to kind of aggregate the tribal knowledge of those who have been in private equity. So doing a good job at that. So my top two advice would be don't self-select out. Do your research and try it. You know, don't say, I can never be a CFO in private equity. If you feel that you can, interview and see what it's like and check out the platform. I'm looking forward to reading the articles and the references that you have there.
Great. Well, thank you for the pitch on that. we're trying to create an environment where people can learn from one another. People can have more transparency and people really can benefit for their own careers and in helping guide and build the careers of others. Excited to have had you both speaking on our session today. Really appreciate your time, appreciate all of the attendees' time, and look forward to continuing this conversation online.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thanks. Really appreciate it. Take care.
Take care.
Please tune in to our next episode on striking a balance between organic and inorganic growth to maximize EBITDA multiples. This is guest host Lindsay Gazowski, and thank you again for listening to X Factor.